Okay, so thank you very much first for inviting me to be at this very special conference in memory of my dear friend Emmanuel. And I'm so sorry that I couldn't be here yesterday because of a family event in Istanbul. But I just want to say a few words before I start my presentation. I feel very privileged that I knew Emmanuel, such a kind soul with a high goal, a pure heart and a brilliant mind. And I also feel grateful that I'm presenting this paper here, because this paper was largely influenced and shaped by my last conversations with Emmanuel in the months of May, June 2020, and early week of July 2020. So it couldn't have been written without those interactions. And we are now revising it for an academic journal, and now we have a lot of interactions with David. It is going to be, as you see, a quantitative application of the Bakai-Fahri framework, highlighting the role of input-output networks on a global scale and the importance of complementarities in production on a global scale, which is, of course, going to help us to make a very good quantitative case for global vaccinations. I presented this at the WHO, gave a congressional testimony on it. I even explained it to Republicans through Bakai and Fahri framework. So far, far-reaching conclusions of that work. Anyway, it's a very special paper to me. So it is joint with Cem Çakmaklı, Selva Demiral, Sevcan Yeşiltaş at Koch, and Muhammed Yıldırım at Harvard Kennedy School. So let me tell you what we do by stating the obvious first. COVID is a global crisis. It needs a global solution, and both economic and vaccine policies of rich countries are not aligned with this fact. Still, this is the case. And the point we want to make in the paper, and Bakai-Fahri framework is going to be very helpful for us to make this point, is that even a country eliminates its domestic pandemic. I mean, obviously, we are here in France. I mean, there's just one person wearing a mask. I assume we all have three, four, whatever shots. If you go to a country in Africa, that's not going to be the case. And we are trying to make the point that even a country eliminates this domestic pandemic, like France, like US, that country may still suffer certain costs through its global linkages to the rest of the world, if the rest of the world is still living with the pandemic. Okay? So the paper is going to make this very simple point. It's going to quantify this. It is going to be on the lockdown phase, and most of my presentation is going to be on that. At the end of the paper, I'm also going to talk about the recovery phase because of the recent work we are doing on the supply chain bottlenecks and inflation. Okay, let me start with this figure. This figure is really about trying to match the COVID starts. We are all thinking about these issues, and then we started thinking how to match the sectoral heterogeneity in the disease coming through several things. You lock down the services sector, people sit at their home and order these Pelotons through their iPads, and also that type of heterogeneity, and also contracting the disease depending on where we work, to global input-output production and trade. And this is just like a thinking figure. Later, I'm going to tell you, the details how we do this. But just there's going to be demand and supply side to the story. The top part, COVID starts, there are infections, this is going to alter consumer preferences. We think everything in a global scale with open economy, so there's going to be domestic and foreign demand change. That's going to affect the output through demand side. And the bottom is the supply side story, where we are going to use an epidemiological framework there to get at this issue of labor supply shock, which is going to be very important in Bakai and Fahri framework. And that is going to depend on if you're a worker in teleworkable sector or on site. That's going to affect both your infection rate, also it's going to affect if that sector is under lockdown or if that sector is an essential sector and all that. That's going to give you your labor supply, which is going to be combined with your imported intermediate inputs from foreign countries and the other domestic inputs you use. And that's going to be the supply side story. So this kind of similar heterogeneity, just what Ludwig told you about. And the model we are going to use, we are not going to write down any model, because obviously there are now several models on this. And when we started writing the paper in 2020, and the first version January 2021, the first point is we really want to set up with these disaggregated sectoral demand and supply shocks. And that's, of course, the Emmanuel's work with David. specifically in this paper, we are going to combine these two papers, Bakay Fahri 2022A, that's the AER paper on supply and demand shocks in a closed economy, and their paper, I believe, on the revision Econometrica on international trade with tariff shocks, okay? So we are going to combine those, and we are going to strip down certain elements that, you know, we don't need in this framework, and also to, going to make our life easy, because we will be working with very large matrices, that we will be working with many countries and many sectors. But the whole, you know, the idea, you know, the approach solution is going to be the same. I'm going to show you the key equations, but you just basically start with equilibrium. You perturb the equilibrium with COVID shocks, but these are going to be different at sectors and country levels. So that's why you do need this multiple sector, multiple factors, IO linkages, multi-layer nested CES framework. We are going to borrow from David and Emmanuel. We are going to get rid of no hand-to-mouth consumers, because in this paper, we are not going to do any aggregate demand shock, no fiscal policy, no monetary policy, and flexible price and wages. Sector-specific labor is of course going to be important, that we keep. Now we are, during our revision, we are also adding capital and wage rigidity. But the results I'm going to show you is going to be based on these bullet points, okay? Okay, I'm sure you heard this already, but I just want to go through some equations in detail, because matching to the data is actually not that straightforward, especially when you don't have the real-time data. Again, go back to the world, January 2021, sectoral consumption data is not out, sectoral labor hour data is not out, you know, we don't have anything, right? This is the world where we use the Google mobility data and all these kind of real-time data. So in that sense, I'm going to show those key equations where you need this data that just comes out like with a year and a half delay, and you're in the middle of a shock, and you are trying to quantify things. Okay, so the key equation, starting with, you know, final production, the idea is, of course, you are combining labor and intermediate input bundle. That intermediate input bundle is going to be, you know, composed of sector-specific bundles, and that's going to be aggregating under CES varieties from different countries. Okay, so the typical example here is there is German car industry that uses steel coming from Turkey, China, and the US, and all steel, you know, Germans buying steel from these countries, and this is, there's a high loss of substitution here. That's how it is done in the literature, and that's going to be our baseline. But we are going to relax, because we would like to capture this short-term idea of a lockdown. Then Chinese lockdown, Germany cannot substitute that Chinese steel with Turkish steel, okay? But in the long run, of course, they can be able to. So we are going to show you a full range of results based on that elasticity. Then German car industry also going to be using different inputs, you know, bundling steel, plastic, and all together. Here we are going to assume low elasticity. That is going to be exactly as in David and Emmanuel's paper. We basically use exact same elasticity they are using. And then that is going to be combined with factors. Right now it's only labor, the result I'm going to show you, and that's also going to be low elasticity. Again, we are going to use what they use. And this is basically estimated also in the literature that I will tell you those papers. Okay. So the key data piece is going to be this omega matrix. Ludwig already showed you. On a global scale, this is what we call global trade and production network, global IO network. So that's going to tell you inputs for industry J of country M to be used in producing industry I good in country C. So German car industry buying steel from China, plastic from Turkey, and so forth. The PIC is going to be price of the car, German car, YIC the total output of that industry. When I, this sector index is zero, that's the consumption sector. So Y not C is going to be total consumption in Germany. Then X is going to be this J index inputs. They are coming from country M. PJM is going to be the price of that. And there's going to be these factors. When we have the factors, here is going to be labor, price of that factor is going to be the wage. And this is an important assumption, right? This sector-specific labor. So there are going to be labor producing cars, labor cooking your food in the restaurant and all that. So that's the price equation. And you see here, this elasticity of substitutions phi is going to be bundling the labor and inputs, and we are going to have this less than one. And here I'm going to add an I notation, sector-specific factor, FIC, wage of that, WFIC, price of the intermediate input bundle is going to be that PM, alpha IC is going to be the value added share of the car industry, and N is a set of goods. Okay, just all these standard equations in these multi-layered CES, but since we are going to take these two data, I just want to go through this. This is the price of the intermediate bundle. So now here you are combining steel and plastic, and we are going to assume complementary to the air too. So this epsilon elasticity also going to be less than one. And this omega matrix basically aggregates over this stuff coming from different countries. And this is going to be a very key story in the short run when you start in January 2021 and like think about that first 6 months with the lockdowns in different countries and recovery also in different countries at different times. This is the price, also the sector bundles are getting rights from different countries. Okay, so now this is going to be the important, this kind of open economy trade elasticity, psi I. So this elasticity in the literature, you know, it can come from the production side, consumption side, it's going to be the same in the model. It generally used bigger than one based on the paper by Caliendo and Perro. We are going to, again, show you results on empirical implementation using both that, the standard value used in the literature, and also values less than one. There are papers also estimated these values less than one, the famous earthquake paper by Boham et al. Andrei Levchenko, Nita Pandeli Nayar has a new paper estimating these elasticities in the short run, the kind of 6 months to a year, more than a year. All this range we are using is consistent with all those estimates. Okay, so, and then the idea here again, Germany can substitute steel from Turkey with steel from China, or use them as complements, try to get at this long run, short run issue to capture the pandemic dynamics.
But in the long run, labor is still fixed.
Yes, and the long run here is a 1 year. So the entire thing is for 2021 only. So when I say, you know, short run, it is like the first 6 months, long run is a year, but yes, exactly, yeah. The consumption is going to be Cobb-Douglas. We are not going to do anything there. Your standard Cobb-Douglas, sigma one, and of course, consumers are also consuming goods from different countries. So here we can change this, and we are working on this also. And Robotman's going back to Veronica's and Ivan's work, but right now I'm just going to show you a result with the standard Cobb-Douglas consumption. And this is the consumption price. Again, this trade elasticity, we are going to assume the stuff that comes from the foreign countries is going to be moving together with the, this is the same trade elasticity than the production side, but you can actually differentiate these things. So you can say, well, consumers are going to substitute, obviously, but producers maybe is going to have a difficult time. So you can look at that type of asymmetry too, which we are also working on. But right now they are going to be very at the same time. If they are bigger than one, they are going to be bigger than one together at the same time. Smaller than one, they are going to be exactly the same. Okay. I don't have time to go to details, but basically the idea here is to do the solution exactly as in Bakayifari, local linearization. The nice thing is, and they go through in detail in their paper, when do these the small shocks and small perturbations, the COVID shocks, then you can actually end up with the exact hat algebra, okay? So all we are doing is changing these changes, solving for these changes, D log wage, D log price, and sum of all those equations is going to be adding up to the matrix AND. Okay? Okay. This is just to set up. The contribution of the paper is really this taking this model, literally simplified version of their work, applied to a global setting and matching it to data. Okay, so the contribution of the paper comes from the empirical side. So the starting point is you need those omegas. That is going to come from pre-pandemic input-output metrics. Okay, so this is as of 2019, OECD, ICAO tables. There are other ones you can use. Basically, you are going to end up with very similar values. This is something that changed super slowly. This is the 2019 version. If you go and look at the 2015 version, you are going to see the same thing. If you want to see really what happened during the pandemic, we have to wait until 2023 or 2024. But the idea is really to get the data on network as is, and then introduce this COVID shock, okay? Perturbed equilibrium with COVID shocks. So what you get from this OECD ICIO is the expenditure shares at the end of the day. That first omega I showed you, what is that? That is, of course, there is a structural IO link there, but there's also exports and imports. So it combines the structural links with trade. It is going to be on 35 industries, 65 countries. You know, you have 2,275 by that metrics. And you have to have this initial employment data by sector, and that's going to come from OECD team database. Okay. Let me show you this figure. So, you saw the figure Ludwig showed, and you know, if I kind of did that and combine these two, the left is the country network, and then the right is the sector network, then you would just see a spider web, right? So I'm not doing that on purpose, so you can see the importance of all these links. So I'm just going to show you the like large links, right? In the on the left, the country trade, you will see the trade, you know, over 10% of GDP, and the color coding is going to be more open, less open. Ireland is dark blue, more open country. US is light blue, less open country. And the thickness of the arrows is also going to be the intensity of the trade. So if you just look at that and ignore the sectoral dimension, you are going to miss a lot. So that's why I do these figures separately. The sectoral one, we kind of tend to think in terms of a structural link. But of course, if you envision that sectoral one embedded in the country one, you see how complex it is, and you know how important it is really to match this data carefully. And the sector one too, the tradable, non-tradable sector thing, is going to be important, of course, but it is not going to be on the story. If you only think about tradable sector and exports, imports, you will be thinking about those dark red sectors, computer and electronics, and you know the basic manufacturing goods, as opposed to those non-tradable sectors, as we know, construction, wholesale, retail. They also suffered a lot from these problems during the pandemic. So their linkages to the other sector is going to be important, not just to the first order, but to second order effects, which is very well analyzed in Davis and Emmanuel's work. Okay, so that's the data we use. All the elasticities I already told you, but just to see them all together, we are going to use sigma 1 on the consumption side, consumption bundles and sector over good varieties coming from and countries, so that's going to be the psi. I'm going to vary it between basically 0.2 and 1.5, okay? So basically both production input and consumption with trade is going to be varying on that dimension. So you can go to high substitute to 1.5, you can actually go on to 4.5, but after 1.5 it's not going to matter. That's the standard, the one used in literature, and the 0.2 to 0.5 is these other papers estimated based on the short-run shocks like earthquakes. So we are going to give you the full range on that side. This epsilon is going to be the intermediate bundle one, that's steel and plastic one, that's 0.2. So that's going to come from Bakayifari, also estimated in papers as Atalay and Boehm et al. And this one, again, going to be the same side. And this all goes back, of course, to Barra and Savoyon paper, who argued that Kapp-Douglas production is really going to break down in the short run because it's going to be difficult to substitute among suppliers of the same inputs, which is, again, the story we lived through during the pandemic. Okay, but these are the values for now on the results that I'm going to show you that we are using. How do we feed in the COVID shocks? Okay, to feed in the COVID shocks, yeah. Yeah, we are going to use a range. Okay, sorry, is this working? I don't know. Oops, no, it's not working. Okay, so we are going to use that psi I, so that's the, you know, both on the consumption and on the production side, between 0.2 and 1.5. I'm going to show you a result for the entire range. Yeah. So you will see, okay? Okay, so, any other question? No. All right. How do we feed the COVID shocks? Okay, so this is again, early in the pandemic, you know, we are trying to get at this without real-time data. We are going to feed it using the country infection rates, but we have to turn that country infection rate time varying. First of all, we have to turn the cases into infection rates. And then those infection rates is going to be done sectorally. Okay, we need sector level infection rates to be able to match this model as the first schematic shows you. So I'm going to tell you in a minute how we do that. But before, just in terms of through which equations these shocks entering, demand is going to be just a sectoral demand shifter. This is kind of, you cannot go to your gym, you buy a Peloton story, the caricature story, and supply is going to go through the labor shock, the sector-specific labor shock. As you see, I is the sector, C is the country. So we are just going to enter the shocks like that, okay? Now, how do you do them sector-specific and how do you do them in real time? Again, these labor shortages and consumption changes, they are going to be a combination of supply and demand factors, and we are not observing them in real time. And when we were doing this in January 2021, we said, okay, let's use an epidemiological model. Let's kind of, you know, turn into that model in a kind of a state-of-the-art econometric Garch model. So it will give us this country time variation estimated in a nice way, and then turn it into sectoral you know, model to get the sectoral infection rates by using whatever, you know, the pandemic data available and the sector characteristics. which really goes back to this, you know, notion of you are trying to separate the supply and demand without observing consumption hours by instrumenting with disease. Okay, so that's basically what we will be doing. And the entire thing is going to be estimated for year 2021. Okay, the whole exercise is only for 2021. So basically it is calculating daily shocks piling on each other, because there will be sick people not going to work, other people recovering, going to work. This is going to vary by sector, depending on where you work. And also if you work, you know, to close proximity to others, or if you telework or not. So all that heterogeneity we are going to bring in, that will give us these daily shocks, and then each day you're arriving a new equilibrium, and then you are perturbing that equilibrium following it. Okay, so that's how we do this. To get that sectoral shock, we are going to use this epidemiological model, very standard. This, you know, you've seen this many times. You start with this T is day here. So every day there are susceptible people, infected people, and recovered people. You start with like zero. The dynamics is very straightforward. Everything is governed by this R number. The orange stuff you see on the slide is what you observe in the data. Gamma is going to be this recovery rate that is given by WHO and John Hopkins, and beta is going to be the infection thing. But this is country. We want this at the sector. We want this vary by sector. Okay. To do that, we start with this non-working population in the country, and then we have every sector, every I sector's labor. So we separate that in. Some of that labor is going to be teleworking, and the others on site, the TWI and NI. Okay. So we observe LI and TWI in the data. And of course, you can also be infected at home, and there are going to be people at home. These are kids, retired people, all those other people. So that has the non-working and double the non-working population, all the teleworking people at home. Okay? Then we are going to use these proximity requirements for every sector, basically. If you're a doctor or a fishing person, or if you work at a restaurant, or you're an accountant, or you're a professor, that's going to give you how close proximity you work with others. That's, of course, an occupation level variable, but we match it to the sectors. That prox I variable. And by using the population weighted average of all betas, and then is the population, we back out that beta naught, which is going to be the infection rate for at-home group. Then we can just use that SIR for sector. So this is going to be now like it's going to look like a VAR for every sector, and just evolve the pandemic. Okay, so this is going to give us the 2021 evolution of the pandemic for every sector. Every sector is going to have these changes in S, susceptible people, change in recovered people, and change in infected people. And this is actually very straightforward. So once you are infected and recovered, you are going to recover in 14 days. You are not going to get infected again. So we don't have any details like, you know, Omicron wave and double infections and all that. So it's just like kind of one standard way of doing this in the SIR model, but we are bringing it to the sector level. Okay, to get these country-specific time-varying infection rate, we estimate this model for 2020. This is important because 2020, no vaccines. So 2020, we estimate these country-specific infection rates, time varying, then turn into that sector down, this based on work by Chakmak and Shimshek. And then we target that December value. So December 2020 when the vaccines came out, right? So that's our starting point. We get this December 2020 variables, assuming a 14-day recovery, which corresponds to that 0.07 gamma, and getting the basic R number for the country. Then you start from December. At that point, the vaccines are on the table, and you kind of do the whole evolution of the pandemic for 2021 by sector, by country, based on the vaccinations and the lockdowns. Okay, we are going to change those scenarios. How do we do the lockdowns? We have the ICU data, right? So because the pandemic is evolving, depending on the vaccination and the cases, so when the cases reaches the ICU capacity, we put a lockdown in the model. That lockdown means your beta going to go back to zero. Lockdown is 14 days only, and then after that, you are going to increase the pre-lockdown level. Again, everything is done with the available health data at the time. The way we separate these sectors, the I dimension, teleworkable occupations, this is from Dingle and Neiman, we all use that data, and occupation level contact, if you're in, you know, close contact, face-to-face sector or not, is from ONET, and everything is matched to the sector data using the occupation employment statistic from Wales. This is just so that you visualize that, you know, this contact intensive sector and teleworkable sector, they are different things, right? obviously there's going to be a very high correlation with the sector specific infection rate and the fact that you're a contact intensive sector, and that is what, you know, we are by construction doing. That's accommodation and food at the top, 80% correlation. Teleworkable sector, there is going to be a negative correlation. Education sector down there, that is lower sector specific infection rate, but that is weaker than the contact intensive nature of the sector. This is just because it is a disease model, epidemiological model. Okay, is this a good proxy for a labor supply shock? When we were doing it, I mean, we had a hunch that it is a good proxy, but of course we didn't have this type of data. Now we have this data. This is US Census Pulse Survey. So they use a representative population, again, US, only US, unfortunately, not all the other countries, but it gives us an idea for the US, and it is good that it is US because US didn't do many lockdowns, right? So this is percent of households stating a reason for not going to work. Just, there are so many reasons, and you know, you can see all of them in the paper, but we group them, government mandated, so basically if government closes stuff, business related, your business went out of the business, or you are furloughed, something like that. And individual pandemic related are all reasons, like you have COVID, you are taking care of somebody with COVID, you know, you are afraid that you will get COVID, so all those things grouped there. So pretty much most people saying the reason they are not going to work is individually COVID related. Obviously other stuff is COVID related, but individually COVID related. This is not working population 18 plus and extraordinary time. When you look at the time series variation of this, on the left, so this not working for COVID-19 related reasons is the red, and the COVID case is the blue. Obviously, they are going to be very highly correlated over time. And on the right, it's our labor shock. I'm showing you, of course, aggregated to the US country level, but we are going to use at the sector level. But that is the labor shock we are going to use in blue, and that's also going to be correlated with this, you know, the reason not going to work being COVID related. How many minutes do you have? Five? Zero?
No, you have plenty of time. You have 25 minutes.
Okay. Not quite.
So I don't know if you explained it, sorry. So there's lots of data relating demographic characteristics across countries.
Yes, yes. No, exactly. So this is for US, just like, you know, to supporting evidence. But for this entire thing is going to be done for every sector, every country. So the infection rates are all country sector specific, and every country is going to be solved by itself, right? Yeah, exactly. So, but that's exactly right. So, and the other piece of evidence, this is from EU again. I mean, US is different for certain reasons. EU is different for certain reasons. But this is just to get at this idea that, you know, the way we do this through the labor supply shock, of course, going to feed into the intermediate input production, that's going to feed into the other countries' shock. So this is a survey from EU Commission. This is a stratified random sampling. The nice thing with this survey is this goes back to after 2000, and they ask three questions. So which of these reasons limits your production? Two firms. Firms can say insufficient demand, labor shortages, or shortage of material and equipment. And the very nice thing you see in the Great Recession, 2008-2009, almost 70% of the firms say insufficient demand limits their production. When you come to the COVID, that was also the case originally, the blue line, but then it drops and the shortage of material and labor shortage becomes the main reason. I'm zooming in on that period, starting 2019 quarter four, the first observation on the right, and then going to the end of 2021, I believe. No, yes, end of the first quarter of 2022, you see that almost 45% of the firms saying insufficient demand limited their production early in 2022. Then, of course, when the recovery came, that went down, and the starting end of 2020, literally when the vaccination started, beginning of 2021, the 45% of the firms, almost 50, saying what limits their production is short of material. This is a supply chain bottleneck story and the labor shortage. Okay, this is from the EU. Okay, now the personal consumption data is you know, available from US at the sector level. So to get to the infection-related demand side, remember this: using a disease and infection is try to instrument the supply and demand shocks to separate them. We are going to do it at the US level, unfortunately, this one. US sectoral consumption data regress on the infections over the course of 2021, get the elasticity, and then we predict demand shocks to other countries using their infection rate, but estimated rate. So we still use their infection rate And then that's also going to be sectoral, but this parameter based on the US consumption rate, okay? But for robustness, again, going back to Helen's comment, we have credit card data for 5 countries. We are also using that for robustness, okay? Consumption data is now being available, but still not for all the sectors. Remember, we are working with 45 sectors. If you look at the EU data right now, it's only available for 3 sectors, right? That's the problem. When you want to work with the full network, you need all the sectoral data. Okay, and US data is, of course, 66 sectors. That's what David and Emmanuel use in their AER paper, 66 sector US data. Okay, now let me show you the key results. So how this all comes together is, again, the idea is very simple. You connect everyone through this global trade and production network, and you really work through a health shock, right? It is a COVID shock, and it comes from demand and supply feeding to both equations, but it is really working with the infections affecting the labor supply and consumer demand, and that is going to be amplifying losses, and this is kind of the supply chain bottleneck story. So health shock is being amplified via the global IO network. How does vaccination work in our model? So we are not getting into details of this country uses that vaccine, this many percent is vaccinated in every single country. We do a very simple exercise. So vaccination eliminates labor supply shock and normalizes demand, everything at the sector level. We are going to use percentages, right? And we are going to say if African countries vaccinated 20%, we are going to run a scenario like that. If the advanced country, Europe, vaccinated 80%, we are going to run a scenario like that. But I'm going to show you a very basic scenario where at the end of 2021, all the rich world is like vaccinated fully, which means sectoral labor supply shock is gone, sectoral demand normalizes, whereas emerging markets and developing economies, they only able to vaccinate half of their populations. We are not even that level. Yeah.
I'm sorry if you're going to show these results in a second. I thought a big channel was that spending shifts to goods, and then the bottlenecks are because the shipping network is stressed. Not so much that the labor shocks per se prevent stuff from being produced or delivered. Is that going to be a part of what the rest of the
economy? Yeah. So we are now doing detailed mapping the two, because we have all this data on the delivery times, shipping prices and all that. But the model is not going to get into any of stuff like that. I mean, it is going to have some delay component because everything is sold daily, but not specifically because that shipping delayed and that delay. So everything works through imported inputs and labor, basically.
But there is a channel for more.
Yes, of course. Yes, exactly. Yeah, that channel is there, but it is captured very broadly. Yeah, I mean, the data is not going to be measured, so that's why we work with like that. But again, in a very reduced form, now we are correlating all those measures of bottlenecks with also these shocks. Yeah. Okay. So this is the key result. What do you see here again? Remember, the 0.6 and 0.2 elasticities exactly as in David and Emmanuel's paper. They are assumed that value always. They don't change. What is 0.6? That's the substitution between labor and intermediate inputs. And 0.2 is between intermediate inputs, plastic and steel. And consumption is Cobb-Douglas, sigma 1. Given those elasticities, the x-axis here varies the trade elasticity, okay? So it goes to one after one. I am not showing because basically you go to 1.5, 3, 4, 5, you will always get the same. Nothing happens after one, basically. But a lot happens here, right? And you can take it back to 0.2, then you are going to get even larger estimates. Of course, you're going back to almost full Leontief case. But the nice result here is on the y-axis, I'm showing the world in blue, rich world in orange, and the poorer world in green, as percent of 2019 world GDP, the losses they have in 2020, okay? Because of the COVID shock, what they lose in 2021 as a percent of 2019 GDP for all the world is almost 2.5%. Of course, the stark result here is rich countries are losing 1.2% of 2019 world GDP if elasticity is 0.6. You go to large elasticity, it becomes negligible. Emerging markets are always going to have a loss, regardless of the elasticity, because their own pandemic is going through here. The point of this figure is there is no pandemic, no health shock in advanced economies. I vaccinate everybody in the advanced economies, okay? So this rate loss is going to be important, of course, but again, so this the reason why also we are showing starting 0.6, this is the elasticity, the short elasticity estimated in the work by Levchenko and Nitya Pandelner.
Do you have any intuition why there is a jump in 0.7 to 0.75?
Yeah, so there is no, yeah, exactly, from 7 to 7.5. We are looking into that. There is some sort of nonlinearity. Okay. Even more interesting result may be this. So now I am showing again the x-axis, the same variation in the trade losses. I'm going from 0.6 to the 1, and that jump is not as stark here, but this is plotting something else. This is now you get the 2021 loss and you look at everybody's share. Okay? How much of that? So these two columns, the orange and green, add up to 100 here. So how much the share of rich economies for 2021 COVID losses, and how much of that is due to emerging markets, poor economies. And you see with the low trade loss, the 0.6 is almost half off. Okay, rich world also shares a lot. You go to higher loss, obviously, you know, pretty much the entire burden is going to be on the emerging markets, and the share of the rich countries is going to go down. I mean, there's still some, you know, effect, obviously, because even it is substitutable, they are still going to suffer from these sector-specific labor supply shock feeding into the inputs and imported inputs. But it is, instead of like almost 50% rich country share in the world loss, now they are less than 10%. Okay, so this elasticity is going to be very important in those magnitudes. Okay, so this is the country heterogeneity again, so that you see the red colors means things are bad. Okay, so your losses are high. Of course, they are all the emerging markets and developing economies. Why? Because they are still dealing with the pandemic. Okay, so the shock never disappears for those guys. And the yellow colors are almost no loss or very small loss, and they are rich countries, because this is the elasticity, psi elasticity is one here. And you see here, when I go to 0.6 elasticity, everything becomes darker, because now rich countries are also using, and this shows you the country heterogeneity. This heterogeneity is going to be linked to openness. So Europe is going to be losing more than the US, okay, with elasticity. Even you use the same elasticity on both of them, because of where they are in the supply chain and their linkages, certain countries, certain rich countries are going to lose more than the other rich countries. Okay, let me tell you couple things on the recovery phase. Although this paper doesn't focus on that, now I have other papers looking at that. Why this is important? Because we start with these supply chain disruptions, in a sense, with the original supply shock, and that can come from lockdowns, contracting disease, not working, that can many things going on there. And you already have these supply-demand imbalances, but then you are going to make them worse because of this stimulus, right? Why is that? You start again with these relative demand shocks, right? You shut down your service sector, you increase demand for goods, there's also the fear factor there, uncertain to force savings, all those things. Then you bring fiscal policy in town at a very large scale. So these demand changes are going to be now put on steroids, because the constraint is still there and services sector still not recovered. And then the goods demand increase more. This is the story everybody tells, how they are buying their second Peloton and second Vosher. This is also very American specific, by the way. I don't think in Europe people were doing that. But anyway, so that story there, that's why you see two arrows going up next to goods. This is, of course, going to make the supply chain disruption worse, right? Because you are pumping up the demand in an already constrained world, and of course the result is going to be inflation. Now, in a world of personal supply chain disruptions, these were the original news, early 2021, and one particular one is of interest to us in the Reuters January 28, 2021, when Taiwan asked Germany for vaccine to ease the semiconductor shortage, which of course affected the world a lot. But this news never went away, right? Then you came to August, November, October, we still have the same news, how the supply chain issues and COVID cases stumbling the recovery. And then of course the most recent Chinese case, although we are now in a world of almost no pandemic, we know that this is not the case in China. Okay, so how to think inflation here? I mean, we already have a lot of theoretical papers that gives us a lot of guidance on this issue. So this heterogeneity here is again going to be very important, right? So this original negative supply shock in certain sectors created negative demand shock in other sectors, the Keynesian supply shocks idea, demand normalization is going to add to that, okay? It's going to create further bottlenecks, further labor shortages, further supply shocks. So work of Ivan with Veronica and Ludwig and Guido, of course, David and Emmanuel. I have a paper with Pierre Olivier, Nick and Veronica, where we look at the fiscal policy in this environment. And that's also going to be extremely important in a sense of inequality in the fiscal policy, right? So you were already in a world of these constraints, and you bring fiscal policy complete uneven by country, by sector, okay? So that's going to add up to our problems. Now, how to think inflation and monetary policy in the setup? Again, we have a lot of theoretical papers here. I'm forgetting Elisa's paper, that should be here too. But the key theoretical insight coming out of this work is economies having simultaneously slack and inflation, this connection between aggregate output gap and aggregate inflation being weak, and with asymmetric demand and supply shock, shifting demand across sectors and production networks, optimal monetary policy obviously, you know, targeting relative prices. But think this now a global scale with global unevenness in fiscal policy and try to quantify the inflation.
I have a question, yeah. It's a kind of general question. There was an issue, how much you should increase interest rate when you have inflation.
Yeah.
And one response, for example, Christine Lagarde for a long time, would say, you know, because it's a lot due to these things that you have bottlenecks and maybe increasing interest rate would not do so much, you know, for inflation in this case versus that. Is there? But that's a general question I'm asking.
Right.
Is the fact that now you look at input-output much more closely, are we very
okay?
How much truth is there in what you are saying?
This is a very difficult question. We are at the first stage. Our perspective is first we need to quantify how much of the inflation is from the supply bottlenecks. Okay, before you go that point. So that's the paper that we are doing right now with Giovanni Alvaro Silva and Mohamed Yildirim to quantify Eurozone and US inflation, how much is from the supply bottlenecks. And basically, literally going back to what Janet Yellen said, not foreseeing the unanticipated large shocks stemming from supply bottlenecks led to her 2021 statement on inflation not being a continuing problem. This is the start of that statement you said, how much then we increase, should we increase. But first, let's quantify how much coming from the bottleneck. And this is actually extremely difficult exercise. And again, we are working on this right now, and the key insight comes from this very general corollary one in Davis and Emmanuel's paper, that if you feed in this entire network, you know, and this is the simplified version because we got rid of the technology stuff, but basically this is CPI inflation on the left-hand side, you have your aggregate demand shock, and then you have this every sector employment changes, labor shock entering. It is a very general corollary, and we are using this again to quantify this because you have to match the observed inflation first. So you really cannot do with any framework or just with regression. You have to match that. That's going to their framework help a lot, and then you quantify how much comes from the bottleneck.
Do you count the energy price, which is not really a supply bottleneck? It comes from the expectation of.
Yeah. So this is then they have the full solution. That's what gives you the decomposition, right? The corollary one just tells you. Okay, well, David is there, so you can correct me if I'm wrong. But the corollary one just tells you, you know, how this is going to add to inflation because it enters the negative. When you fully solve the full optimization, everything is going to be optimized with the price and wages and the factor shares and everything. That actually allows you to do the decomposition. This is not going to allow you to do how much is from the bottleneck, how much is from the demand decomposition. Am I missing your question? Yeah, no, that I don't think you can do. Well,
so I think that would show up like a demand shock.
Yeah.
Expect. That would kind of look like a demand shock.
But it's a.
But it's a perfect.
It's a key input, it's not a demand in terms of.
Yeah, it would be like I think it would look like a sectoral demand shock. The sort of thing that you have to know. If it's an expectation.
There's perfect foresight, right? So everything is feeding into this aggregate demand shock, which is a discount factor shock. And it's also going to shift relative sectoral demand. So, but to separate each of them, I think that's going to be hard because you match the observed inflation using that aggregate demand shock, exactly. And then using that to decompose. But I'm not sure if you decompose every single component. But I can tell you that Europe and US is going to look different. And that's already in the data, right? When you look at the headline core services and goods, I mean, U.S. started earlier than everyone, we know that. But then this is U.S. in purple, euro area in pink, and U.K. in orange. When you separate in the service and goods, this is still the end of 2021, you see that everything is really by the goods inflation, driven by the goods. And then, of course, the consumption side is going to tell you the story. Again, this is nominal and real consumption in U.S. and euro area. The black line is you go back to 2019 peak, you see that in U.S., the pickup in the durable consumption started much earlier than Europe. Services also now catch up at the end of 2021. In euro area, it's durable stuff started much later, barely ended up there, and then the service is still not there. Till the end of 2021. In 2022, things are now very different. Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously there is the war side and there is the, all the other issues. We are not getting into that. Just the 2021 case. Okay. To conclude, the economic case for a global vaccination paper is about making this case quantitatively using Bakayifari framework, and it basically tells us that, you know, there is an economic case on top of the moral case. Loss to rich country GDP is larger than the investment needed for global vaccinations. When we did this, we calculated a return of 120 times because that was the investment COVAX needed at the time. Later, this is done much better by Gita and IMF because the investment required much bigger, and we wanted to vaccinate more people. In their work, they are vaccinating 50% of the population. This original number is what WHO said in January 2021, how much COVAX need to vaccinate 20%, which later on we realize that's not going to be enough. But still, there's going to be a high return to this investment. Supply chain disruptions can stay here as long as pandemic stays and with stimulative policies. We might stop the stimulative policies now with tightening the monetary policy. But again, this is a, you know, global thing. Unevenness at the sector country level is very important. If China is going through an Omicron crisis there and locking down, I mean, that's going to have an impact on our lives this side of the world. Fiscal policy is not a global solution here. This result comes from my paper with Pierre-Olivier, Nick and Veronica, because there's going to be limited international spillovers when you have these supply chain issues. And given the extent of globalization, the result is basically, you know, it is a global open economy paper. No economy fully recovers until the every economy recovers. Thank you.